No.
That's all you have to do. Over now. Well, I certainly enjoyed the book. It was...
I'm very glad.
A very impressive debut for someone who's been around for a long time and who has never written a novel. Why is that?
Why have I not written a novel?
Yes, why did you wait? You are now in your 50s.
Yes.
Why did you wait so long to start writing?
Not by choice. It was not my doing. I started out pretty high. You know, I was doing short stories and they were getting into the New York and I was getting into the O. Henry collections and everything was blooming. And then I signed a contract for two books with the man who published this one. Just that happens to be by accident. And it was as though a lid had closed down. And I developed a real block, writing block. And I know people don't really believe in writing block. I experience it. People experience it in different ways. I experienced it as people who have phobias experience. It's one way of, I guess, reacting to it. I had real panic reactions. It's like people who can't cross a bridge, you know how they get all physical, and I really can't. I got that way about working on the book. And I had a terrible time. And I tried and tried and tried. And I just went, I couldn't do it.
Now, let me get this straight. At one point in your life, you were writing, turning out short stories and publishing them.
Right.
And all of a sudden, when you sat down to begin to write a novel, you couldn't do it.
Yes, I don't know whether it was the idea of the novel or the fact that I'd signed a contract for two books or just what was happening in my life aside from the books. I don't know what it was.
What, did you sit down at the typewriter and nothing, no ideas would
come? No, I never had that problem. I always had lots of ideas for stories. But I think I had a terrible sense, a terrible fear of not doing justice to it, not doing justice to an idea. I wrote a lot. But I never got it together into stories or into... I wrote two stories during all those years that I published in quarterlies. And a friend of mine said he had the impression that I sat down every 5 years and knocked out a short story and then said, well, that's that for 5 years. You know, it wasn't like that at all. I mean, I really thought about it every day. I had tons of notebooks. I had therapy. I read everything that I came across about writing block. Most people think it's a sort of self-indulgent thing, or you're lazy, or it's a prolonged stall, like people who sharpen a lot of pencils before they get down to write the book, you know, or write anything, because it's painful to write anything, it's hard. I think, in a way, I had such an exaggerated respect for the whole business of writing, and I wanted to do it so well that, and I don't know, they tell you it's a fear of success, they tell you it's fear of failure, nobody knows.
But you were doing other things. Apparently you began to develop a career in advertising.
Yes. Well, I've worked for almost 25 years in advertising.
Not the same firm.
Yeah.
Really the same firm?
Yes, that one. J. Walter Thompson.
But isn't there a horrible turnover in advertising?
Mm-hmm.
Ruthless, dog-eat-dog, and you survived the 25 years in a creative role?
Yes. That has been less true of J. Walter Thompson, I think, than of some agencies, because Thompson had always had a certain kind of pride, I think, in, you know, keeping people, in people wanting to stay, and in getting people lined up with jobs that would make them want to stay. It's sort of unusual in the advertising business. I think the whole advertising business may have changed. It is a youth-oriented business. There's no doubt about that.
It was broadcasting.
I guess so. Maybe everything is in this country these days.
Yeah, it's frightening, isn't
it? Very frightening.
Have you noticed the older we get, the younger other people look?
Isn't it amazing? You know what's astonishing? I was saying this the other day to a friend. It seems to me that, and certainly in advertising, possibly in broadcasting too, youth is considered to be an achievement. You know, young people are not treated as though they happen to be young, which is the way when I started out, you were treated like you were young, but you'd probably get over that. We hoped you'd get over that, because young meant that you were probably a little feckless, you know, you probably weren't as responsible as you should be, you probably didn't have experience, you know, but you'd mellow, you'd get better. But now, youth is, it's like perfect pitch, you know, if you're young, it's somehow you've done it to yourself. You've achieved something by being young. I see it all the time in advertising.
You are the creative director.
No.
No?
No, I am I'm the editor of a publication called JWT News, which is an international company publication. It goes to all of the offices in Thompson internationally. And
so you're the
I write and edit
their
that.
House
yes.
organ.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's a kind of house organ, but it's a very we don't call it a
Where
house
did
organ.
I get the impression you were creative director?
Because Jim Patterson, who was creative director, wrote Black Market.
Oh, he is the creative.
Yes.
Oh,
yes.
Oh.
And the men I
got,
work for.
Confused.
Well, there are three of us who have new books, which is you know, a story in itself.
Who's the third?
Arnold Grisman, who is the I think his title is. He's an executive vice president. I think he's assistant to the chairman for creative resources.
Well, it sounds like you have an article for your magazine there.
Yes.
House organ or whatever you call it.
Yeah.
J. Walter Thompson execs turn out.
That's right. All in 1 year. All in a short space. His came out. Arnold's came out in October, I think, and then mine came out at the very end of February, and then Jim's came out in June.
What are some of the things you've done over the 25 years you've been at J. Walter
Thompson? Oh, I've worked on just about every account that's been around.
What are some of the accounts that
you've
had?
Oh, I have worked on Scott, and I worked on Warner Lambert, and just about everything Kodak. I've worked on, I think I even worked on, yes, I did work on Ford, even. That was in a, you know, kind of bringing in the girls thing for a go-around, as they say in the advertising business.
Well, something happened not too long ago that made you want to start writing again. Tell me what that was.
Well, I think it was a lot of things. I was determined to write. I was absolutely determined. And I had tried a lot of different things. And I had been writing a lot of letters. I was separated from a good friend of mine, and he and I were writing letters constantly. And that loosened me up a lot. I wrote all the time in my job, you understand. I wrote every day in my job. That didn't do it. It's a different kind of writing. But the letters, I guess, helped to dislodge some of this block. And then, by accident, I took a poetry workshop. And I had never had any intention of being a poet or writing poetry.
Why was that an accident? You walked in the wrong room?
No. I had thought of taking a fiction workshop. And the fiction workshop was closed, or it had been struck or something, where they weren't giving it that year. And I called I guess poets and writers, somebody gave me some names to call, and I called some people. And somebody said, well, I think they're doing something at the National Arts Club along those lines. So I called there, and it turned out that they had an opening in a poetry workshop. And I thought, well, why not, you know? So it was wonderful. We had a lot of fun. And I had no...
You actually wrote poems?
Yeah, they were terrible. But I had no expectations of myself, you know, and it was a whole, you mean, altogether new people who are obsessive about writing, who came from all kinds of different jobs, who did all kinds of different things during the day. It's a subculture in New York, all over the country, I'm sure, maybe all over the world, people who write poetry. And they were good, you know, they really were good. And I knew I would be terrible, but what else could I have been but terrible? You know, I didn't set up to be a poet. And I got better and better, and it was an enormous amount of fun. And I think it made me less self-conscious about the fiction writing. It certainly helped me a lot. And then I went on and took another one and another one, you know, and then I got to where people were, the instructors were saying, well, you better send these poems out. These are good. These are publishable poems, you know. And then I thought, I hope I don't develop a poetry block, you know. Then I'd really be in trouble. I wouldn't be able to write anything. And I decided to take a course at Columbia, and I sent some short stories that I had published, you know, over the years, I told you, to the instructor, who was Maureen Howard, the novelist, and she said she'd like to have me in the course, and I went to the class up at Columbia, and the first night we met, she gave an assignment. She said, I guess nobody wants an assignment. I said, I want an assignment, you know. So she gave me an assignment. She gave the class an assignment, and I was the only one who did it. And it was to take some material and treat it as though it were the opening of a novel, and to do it again as though it were the opening of a short story, and to see if they were different. Theoretically, they should be technically different. Well, I sat down, and I started to write. And I wrote 20 pages, and I brought it into class, and I said, I'm not altogether certain what this is going to be. It's not finished. And she said, "Will you read it?" And I read it to the class. It became the first 20 pages of the book without any changes. And she said, "Can you sustain this?" And I said, "Yes." And I knew I could. I just knew at that moment. I have goose flesh, you know. I mean, as I tell you this, because it was such an, to me, it was an absolute turning point. I knew I could do it then. And she said, "Do you think this is a novel?" And I said, "Oh, yes, it's a novel." And I went on.
So you forged ahead.
And I forged ahead, and I worked on it every weekend.
You had an assignment, but how did it evolve in your mind that it was going to shape up in the way that it did?
I have
the characters.
No idea. I don't know. I don't know.
You just open with Rambo out there somewhere? And
yeah. Yeah, exactly. I have always worked, written fiction, to find out what would happen next. I've had feelings about people and some sense of what the characters were like. But I've never been able to outline a plot or do anything like that. That would be mechanical to me. That would, because it, you know, it grows as you do it, as your own curiosity, and it excites you and it pulls you, drives you along, and you become, it's a very mysterious process.
One of the interesting things about Available Light is Kitty.
Kitty,
now, Kitty,
yes.
I sometimes forget the characters in books in titles. I have a terrible thing. I could read a book last week and not remember the title, and sometimes I forget the name of the
author. Well, you read a lot of books.
But one interesting technique you use, Kitty's diary, or journal.
Yes.
Diary, I guess.
Yeah.
And it almost always focuses on her relationship with her father and the feeling that she was directly responsible for her father's death.
Yes.
Now, this was a very interesting touch. How did that come about, or did it just happen spontaneously?
It happened spontaneously. I had the feeling of a girl who, a woman, because she's a woman, she's not a young girl. She's 36 at the end of the book. She's 35 at the beginning of the book. 36 at the, she's at her 36th birthday at the end of the book. Of a woman whose relationships with men were marked in some way, blighted in some way, by something that had happened in her childhood. And not a victim, not a born victim. Kitty has a lot of juice. You know, she's an achiever. She's really a woman with a lot going for her. She's intelligent, and she's funny, and she's sharp, and energetic, and all those things. And yet, her life doesn't, she can't seem to get a grip of it, can't seem to get, hold it together, and move on. And this is partly because she has this old thing in her childhood, this thing of the father's death, and the mysterious death that nobody ever really discussed in the family. Nobody ever really said what happened. And there's a kind of conspiracy of silence where she feels that she was responsible. Her sister feels that she was responsible. The mother feels ultimately the responsibility was hers. And Kitty's lover says the death was accidental. So, you know, they may all be right on some level.
Well, there's another character, and I remember her, Dorinda.
Dorinda.
Now, I thought it was kind of interesting that all of the chief male characters developed a relationship with her. And I was a little puzzled by that. I couldn't, like Mr. Conrad, I was startled to find out that he had developed the relationship and acquired the baby and all of this. And I thought that was kind of unusual.
Well,
a little bit about that.
Dorinda's a kind of, you know, she's a great wad of hormones. She's a kind of, somebody called her an earth mother or a kind of fertility goddess, you know, and contemporary fertility. In a way, I suppose she's a punked out kid who is very hedonistic. All she's interested in is gratifying her own desires, but she's also, she doesn't know what they are. She doesn't know what she wants, you know. She's all over the place, and she's available to every man who comes along, and she actively seeks out relationships with men, but they don't mean very much to her, you know. It's a, she's a kind of a shopper around her, you know. And she's, I think, a very contemporary figure in a lot of ways. You know, there's a whole lot of this sort of aimless trendiness that doesn't add up a whole lot. I kind of like Dorinda. A lot of people don't like Dorinda and feel she's villainous, but I don't really feel that she's villainous. And, of course, in the end, she becomes what she started out to be, which is another kind of a very nurturing mother in a certain sense, but maybe also a devouring mother. I mean, Mick is a nurturing mother. Kitty's mother is a very nurturing mother, also a devouring mother in some way.
Pregnancy and birth is almost an obsessive theme.
Yeah,
in this
it
book.
Is. Right.
Why is that?
Yeah. I think because pregnancy and, you know, having a child and reproducing yourself and going on represents hope in life, you know, a hope for the future, a hope for yourself to start at the top, do it over, revise anything that's gone wrong in your life, and this time get it right. And it seems to me to have a baby is a great act of faith, you know. I mean, a lot of people are having babies and not looking at it as a great act of faith, but it really is.
Some people look upon it as an accident.
It is an accident as well, very often. Yeah, it's both. But I suppose there are lots of acts of faith that come about in an accidental way.
Well, the book has been written and published, and the reviews are in, and they are almost all very good. Maureen Howard, Grace Paley, I'll give you nice blurbs. How does it feel that you now have this behind your belt?
Wonderful. It's terrific. It's astonishingly satisfying after all of this, you know, misery for so many years, trying to sit down and write a book. And then this book was written in 2.5 years. You know, I ran in place for 25 years, and for a long, long, long time. And then I wrote the book. I mean, it was a long... The girl in the book talks about stalling and saying she has a lot of trouble getting on with her life because she stalls. Well, that's a long stall, you know. It's a very long wind-up before the pitch. And so it was very nice when people liked the book, and they have liked it. It's been terrific.
Well, you're no longer stalling, and the block has been broken. Are you back at your typewriter?
Yeah, yeah.
And it's working? Mm-hmm. It's coming?
Yes.
Flowing?
Yes.
The juices are flowing?
Yes, it's been great. It's really been an incredible experience. I can't tell you how many people have written to me that I knew when I was a kid saying that now they're going to direct the film that they've always wanted to direct. You know, that now they're going to do something that they felt, well, maybe at 55 you say, well, I'm not going to do that. But, you know, it's true. I mean, you can do it. It does happen.
So when you're 50 or 55, what are you going to do? Just stop? Just go into a dark closet and shut the door?
No, but don't you think there are people who say, well, you know, who have a kind of dream. I don't mean their daily life and all that. They people, accomplished people, capable people. But still, they say, well, someday I'm going to do a lot of advertising agency producers, writers, direct. Someday I'm going to do my own feature, going to direct a feature. Well, as you get on, you probably think, well, if I haven't done it by now, maybe I'm not going to do it. But a lot of friends of mine have said, well, you did it, you know, so I'll do it. Everybody directs his own feature, you know.
Yeah, I think what happens to a lot of people in their 40s and 50s, they find that their career gets stalled. They're not going to become president of CBS News or head of J. Walter Thompson or United States Senator, all of these things. And they tend to go to work, and they know that they're probably not going to get out of that rut very easily. That's where the career has ended. What they can do, however, is to do something entirely different, which is exactly what you've done.
Yeah.
I mean, you have sat down to write a book. But I've read about people who have decided to make career changes in their late years. They've gone on to college and become lawyers, or they've sought other things, or they...
Well, you know, we were talking...
People do that all the time, but, I mean, that's one way to end this period where you feel, well, I'm just going to go to work and just wrap up the last quarter of my life.
You and I were talking before about a youth culture, you know, about how pervasive this attitude is. And it's no wonder that people in their 40s and 50s think, well, I can no longer claim to be 25 or 30 or 35, you know. It's no wonder that they get discouraged sometimes. But there is a whole lot of new life. You know, I mean, you don't really change. I think one of the other lessons that you learn as you get older is that you don't get any older, you know. That if other people didn't respond to you as though you were older, you'd never know. If you didn't have a mirror in the house, you'd never know that you'd gotten any older because you're just as young as you ever were, you know. Nobody really changes, I think. That's one of the things that I find very interesting and exciting about a character, and that, you know, old people are very, very often very vivacious to write about or to consider as fictional characters because they don't lose that vitality of youth. It's
well,
all in there.
Their personalities don't really.
No.
Unless they get really old, and they get childish and cantankerous.
Yeah, sure.
That's the onslaught of senility. But I'm not old, but I did go back to my 25th high school class reunion a few years ago. Well, maybe I am older than I thought. But I went back and I looked at my former colleagues, classmates.
Uh-huh.
And I could see physical changes in us, but we were all pretty much the same as we were.
Isn't
when
it
we
the
were.
Truth? Yeah.
The dumb ones were dumb, and the bright ones were bright, and the pretty ones were pretty. And nobody had changed. The sullen ones were still sullen.
That's exactly right.
Nobody had really changed.
I saw a man I hadn't seen for a long time, Dick Humphreys, a writer, you know, and he was an instructor. I took a course from him when I was a real young kid. And he, I think, then had just written Home from the Hill, you know. And here we are, two white-haired folk, you know, and we met again. And the minute he opened his mouth, the minute I said anything, was right back years ago, you know. I mean, neither one of us seemed to have changed.
Picked up right where you left off.
Yeah, no, you know, it's true, because nothing, you know that person, you know them forever, you know. So it's heartening. I suppose it's discouraging if you're stuck with a, you know, a terrible disposition to begin with, but to think that you're not going to do any better is too bad.
Well, people have bad dispositions, like myself sometimes, don't know it.
Oh, well, I don't mean crankiness or anything like that. It's probably merciful if you're cranky and you don't know you're cranky.
No, they don't know they have bad dispositions.
No,
they,
right.
They just think everybody else has somehow gone off on the wrong track.
Yeah, sure.
Well, Curly, it was certainly a pleasure meeting you, and I enjoyed Available Light, and I want you to get back to the typewriter as soon as you leave the office and turn us out another book.
Thank you.